So I want to talk for a few minutes today on the Ordinary Mind Koan that we took up during the Koan seminar last week. I'll start by reading it in a second. I do want to say that there were three or four, five people here last week who hadn't been here very much, and so with apologies to all you grizzled veterans, I intended the talk partly as something that would be useful for people who were just getting into practice, but here we are, and let's see if it can be useful. And certain things I was going to spend a lot of time on, I'll maybe talk about more quickly, and we'll see how far we get, and maybe we'll continue another week with this as well. But so here's the koan, which most of you know, the really famous Ordinary Mind Koan. Zhaozhou asked Nanchuan, "What is the way?" Nanchuan said, "Ordinary mind is the way. Should I try to turn toward it? If you try to turn toward it, you move away from it. How can I know the way if I don't turn toward it? The way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing. Thinking you know is delusion. Thinking you don't know is blankness. When you truly reach the way, it's as vast as space itself. How could we talk about this in terms of it's this or it isn't this?" With these words, Zhaozhou suddenly understood. So it's a nice koan to talk about in a number of respects, and one would be in the koan discussion sometimes there's a distinction made between practice points and dharma points, which are finally no real distinctions, but that is, a koan may suggest something about how to go about your practice, and at the same time, in a related way, it may tell you, or at the end of the koan, you may learn something crucial about the Dharma or what the point of practice is. This one is a particularly productive koan in that there are a number of different sort of both practice points and Dharma points in them to focus on. It's also true, and again, all of you guys know this, but one of the ways in which it really points towards sort of how do we sit and what do we practice, and then what is it the practice is leading us toward, is the notion that way or Tao has a number of really different meanings. So apparently in the Chinese, and it was the Chinese term, it was developed by the Chinese, and like a lot of the other Chinese terms, it's got a very literal and practical sense. So I think that Tao, among other things, is just like a kind of corridor in which people could pass each other. So it really is just a way or a path in that sense. So that would suggest that to follow the path is to have some kind of practice that will get you somewhere, just like a corridor could get you someplace. But then we also all know that the Tao or the way is also the teaching or the Dharma. And we also know that it's also everything that is, what's going on, the way things are. Ezra Pound, who's sometimes a mouthpiece for Mussolini, but when he wasn't being that, was a really great poet and was actually influenced by Taoism, even though he didn't know it, says in the piece in Cantos, "What you depart from is not the way." So if you think you've left the way, what you think the way is mistaken, because you can't ever leave it. And so in that sense, this koan will point both toward how we can get there and the fact that we're always there already. And as I said, I think there are a number of kind of practice points. And in our discussion last time, which was really terrific, I thought really pretty much all of them got touched on. And so I want to just really kind of amplify a little bit of some of what we said and some of what we implied. I remember Elizabeth responding to, "If you try to turn toward it, you turn away from it," with this gesture of her hand, sort of, oh, you know, that gesture of turning is already wrong. Pretty clearly, and I think this would be clear to everybody here, it's not just an empirical mistake. I mean, it's not like, oh, this time I turned left, but I was really supposed to turn right, or if I turned forward, I was really supposed to turn back, but that somehow in the gesture of turning itself, that there's already a mistake that's been made. To sit with this koan, I think, let me back up and say one thing. I want to suggest two things about this koan or any koan in relation to the notion that they're a practice. So one thing that means is that it's a particular kind of deep exercise that you can do that's not proposing itself ever as the only way to live. You know, so if you're working on the koan no, for example, whenever you have a thought, if you say no to it, that's a great practice. But nobody's ever telling you that your thoughts are bad and you should walk around for the rest of your life always when you have a thought, you know, say no to it and try to get rid of it. It's a practice that you do that can have particular fruits, that bear particular fruits, but nobody's saying that it's the only game in town or it's the absolute right way to live always. The other thing about it, though, and I think this is really the other side of the same thing, is that it also is something that you're invited to take up seriously as something that you immerse yourself in. So it isn't the case that there's a point to be gleaned and then you're done, but there's something, there's a kind of chestnut there, and you really have to let yourself spend some time with it. You know, chestnut's probably not the best metaphor for that. But anyway, so if you're with, if you try to turn toward it, you turn away from it, which is certainly one of those points in the koan that might draw your attention. I think one of the reactions that you'll have if you take it up as a practice, as we just began to do last week, is maybe a certain sense of outrage or, you know, being driven crazy either by the koan or by what the koan somehow in a devious way provoked in your own thinking. So Lorraine was talking about how, I don't think it was this one, I think it was some other point in the koan, but that she just, you know, she got in this thing in her head where it just kept going round and round and round and round and round, and there was no way out, and it made her really crazy, you know. So to sit with that provocative quality of the koan is a really important thing to do. So, and again, I think all you know this, but if you sat if I turn toward it, I try to turn against it. I turn away from it. One of the things that's pretty clear right away is that somehow, if every time you reach for something else, you've missed it, that you're looking in the wrong place and that it's already right here. I mean, so there's that. There's a kind of glib quality to that, but I think if you really take that up as a practice, it's really disconcerting and really difficult. Because there's certainly, and this would be one of the things that would come up sitting with this aspect of the koan, we reach for things all the time. It's what we do as creatures and more particularly as human beings. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that. So what we're being invited to do is look at that, not try to eliminate it, but maybe see that it's not the whole ball of wax. There's something else that we might do from a certain, somewhat odd point of view. There's something a little bit odd about that reaching. So we certainly reach for things because we're not the whole universe and there are things outside us that we literally need to stay alive. The notion of dukkha, which as a number of people have pointed out, especially Joan, and I think we've talked about this, is traditionally translated as suffering, is probably better translated as unsatisfactoriness. And you know, the Buddha tells us that there is suffering, life is suffering, there's a cause for suffering and there's a way out of suffering. And so if it meant all human suffering, like the pain of dying or something like that, that probably wouldn't really be accurate. But if it's that sort of gnawing sense of, I'd like it to be otherwise, you know, as Suzuki Roshi said, I should have gone to some other restaurant, which is a really kind of common reaction. I love that, you know, that's a somehow peculiarly human response, I think, and has something to do with thought and language and imagination and so on, which among other things, you know, is likely to tell us it was better yesterday, I want it to be like yesterday again, or somebody told me it could be like this and it isn't like this, so I want it to be like that. So a lot of the reaching that we do is certainly tied up with dukkha, with the things that our mind proposes to us as a better alternative to where we are. And again, it seems to me from a certain point of view, though it would be nice to have a slightly different relation to that, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it would be odd if our imagination never proposed anything other than what's happening right now. I think what happens if you take this up as a practice, and a lot of you have probably done this already, is that there's a lot of time spent in the kind of boing reaction that Lorraine was talking about. You know, what do you mean if I think that there's something someplace else that I want to be with or that I want that I've already turned away from it? You can spend a lot of time in a retreat really kind of driving yourself crazy with some of that. I think at moments you begin to notice the pattern of desire or of unsatisfactoriness or of longing itself. And that kind of is something that you begin to pay attention to and can seem a little bit odd to you in a way. So here you are, and it's the third day of a retreat, and the whole retreat you've been caught up in, oh, why couldn't X be like Y, or why am I not with Z, or something like that. And in many moments, sort of right after that, that'll fall away for a while. And so you might have a moment where it's really clear that there's nothing missing at all from a certain point of view. You know, there's nothing that you need that you don't already have. There's nothing outside what's right here that needs to be turned toward. My feeling is that if that were always your sense of the world, that would also be a little bit peculiar. And so both those senses are real. And that's to say also that the nirmanakaya, where there are distinct subjects and objects that come into relations with one another, that's real. But the dharmakaya sense of that oneness, you know, is also real. At any rate, if you take it up as a practice, what Joan tends to stress, which I guess I've already said, is there's nothing here that you have to get rid of. There's nothing you're trying to eradicate. You just have to watch it and see what else might happen, what other room might be in the house. One of the things that will tend to happen if you do that is things get rebalanced a little bit. If you have moments where there is nothing lacking, there's no place you need to go, it's all right here, and that you feel that in a really deep sense, then the moments when you don't feel like that will have probably a slightly altered quality. So I think what I'm going to do is stop, which will give us something to talk about another time. I want to talk about it's as vast as space itself. How could we say it's this or it's that? Which will bring up it's not a matter of knowing or not knowing. And I especially want to talk about some other time that odd phrase, ordinary mind is the way, which is really strange. So let's leave it here for now, and I'd be happy for any questions or comments or discussion for a couple minutes if there is any.
I'm really glad you talked about this, because even last week I was feeling more friendly toward this koan than I ever have, and you picked exactly the phrase that, you know, I was sitting with, basically. And what you're saying brought it so much more into my life, not just in my practice. You know, like I really got it in my practice, but now I'm really getting it in sort of the rest of life as well. I mean, like, I think I'll take this up at least this week, because it feels really alive. And I mean, the one thing I was thinking about was, you know, yeah, we do, I don't even want to use the word grasp for things. You know, we move toward things, and creation, I mean, desire is the spark of creation, right? And so that's the side of that, you know, that's sort of that other side, and the side where, but that part gets a lot of play anyway. Yeah. Right? I mean, for me at least, I certainly, you know, spark a lot of desires and spark a lot of creations, and it's great fun. And, you know, as I was talking to you a little bit ago, the softening that I'm feeling right now feels like that other side, you know, the just really softening into, it's, I don't know, like you say, it's kind of almost glib to say it's already here. I wish there were some... Yeah. other words that I could say that are deeper. I mean, I sometimes when Mary, when you talk, I feel like I really get the sense of that, you know, that it's already here piece. There's something that the way you're able to express it that I can, or even if you say the same word somehow, I guess I get it from your energy, you know, but anyways, I just great. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. And I think that some of the other stuff in the koan is also a way, I agree with that. I mean, I said the same thing, it's already here, and that seems like it feels glib, it doesn't get at what that's like when something like that is so. And I think other parts of the koan may be, you know, as well as stuff that Mary says, you know, can help us feel our way into it. When you were saying what you said, somehow my mind jumped to Walt Whitman. And he was a really great poet. He was pretty beset, you know. I mean, it was pretty clear that he was pretty uncomfortable with, you know, a lot of his own desires and things like that. So at least sometimes, so a very complicated figure. But there's this really sad thing in the notebooks where he's talking about the Greek philosopher Epictetus, and he says, Epictetus' description of a wise man, he says, all his desires complete and in himself, you know, needs nothing outside of himself, and he looks on his own wishes as betrayers, you know. So there's that sense that you could sort of latch onto, you know, I'm not going to do that reaching. There's nothing else that I need, which is really sort of sad and crazed, you know. And it seems to me that if there is that kind of softening around that sense that, you know, oh, that, you know, that if anything, it makes you more, a little bit lighter and more comfortable with the reaching aspect. Mm. I do want that.
Yeah. It's just kind of interesting to me, like what Jen just said about getting from Mary's energy about the, you know, already here. Because this whole thing about like the Soto sitting with, it's like already complete in some sense versus this whole, you know, koan thing about where having this experience is going to bring some kind of shift. So it's kind of, it's just interesting.
Yeah. I would say, but the I think the koan thing is already complete? Yeah, already complete. You know, but that it raises at first as a sort of dire question. And then says, oh, Mary was right.
All this drama for her.
I hate to deceive you all.
I think the ordinary mind part and the softness that you're talking about is really important. And because this kind of thing, nothing to do with knowing or not knowing, thinking you know, delusion, thinking you don't know, it's blank, this seems to go, seems to be a constant, you know, swing of the pendulum in everyone. But the key, if you want to call it key, seems to be some sort of sensing of softness, you know, and then the identification with who you think you are and who you think's grasping then loses its power. Because there's really, you know, esoterically no I anyway, but, you know, it's sort of that whole dynamic that goes on. But the softness is really an important part of that, for me at least. You know, there's some sort of play in there where it's not so forced.
Yeah.
Like that loop that the girl was talking about, the, yeah. You know, I wasn't here, but yeah. That loop then doesn't have so much power.
Yeah.
When there's a little more, even if the loop's happening.
Yeah.
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 The other thing is, this turning towards it is really interesting, you know, how you turn inside yourself and how you turn just in life, you know, and that, you know, it's really interesting how we're always trying to turn, you know, towards something. Like,
yeah.
We think it's important to turn.
Yeah.
And that I'm constantly going through this thing about that in particular, about a certain view that I have about wanting to do a particular thing. So, and then I'm always, there's another part of me that's saying, well, you don't necessarily have to turn, but you can actually go forward with what you want to do, but don't turn in a certain way.
Yeah.
There's that sort of strange dichotomy, you know?
Yeah.
This is a great poem. I heard a strange Indian philosopher talk about this poem, and he spoke in quite an interesting way about it, too. You know?
Yeah, it's really simple, too, right?
It's very
simple,
it's just,
yeah.
So it's a nice...
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I think a lot of stuff in the koan is if you do these things, then something will soften in a way that will change your relation to turning towards something. Something.
I think the softening occurs when you hold them together, knowing that everything is right here, and in our lives we function by going towards and grasping, and that's those two have to always occur together, and that's where the softening occurs for me. That I know it's all there, and this is right now, but I live my life at the same time, and not to try not to do that, try to forget that everything is really okay here at the same time, and that's what that's what feels where it softens for me.
Can't go into inertia.
Yeah.
When you,
yeah.
What's interesting is that when you make it either or, it disconnects them when they're really not disconnected at all.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So
yeah.
That's really good.
That's the piece that really helps me.
When you said, you know, it's not trying to turn toward, I thought, yeah, because not trying to turn toward would be moving away, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's a different form of...
Yeah, but that's right.
Would be moving toward it. It would be, not trying.
Or
the
something
same
else.
Thing is turning toward it,
Yeah. It's like, if I sit really still, maybe I will be there already. So the one thing I'd recommend to you about the Cohen way is I really think, and most of you know this already and have experienced a lot of it, but if you really sit with the part of a Cohen like this, like in a retreat for several days or something like that, then some of the stuff we're talking about, it really feels like it happens, like something shifts, you know, and it's not once and for all by any means, but some of the stuff that we're just kind of adducing right now, I mean, you really feel like, oh, so that...
That's true.
Like. Yeah, they weren't kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it happens, in other than the Cohen.
Of course, yeah, of course.
You know,
yeah,
so, of course. I mean, that's where my experience comes from. But I really enjoy hearing this at this way, you know, because it's all the same thing. It's there's. How would you even word the difference? I mean, it is different in some ways, but it's all the same thing.
Yeah, maybe. So I remember, what's the name of Joan Halifax's sensei, Beata Stolte. I remember listening to a really good talk with her on sort of breathing techniques and stuff like that. And I was thinking, oh, I don't do that at all, but a lot of the states that she's talking about, I feel like I got through Cohen's. And I would think for you, it's like, oh, a lot of the stuff that the Cohen's are pointing to, it's like, oh, that's not how I got there, but I knew all this already.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and it's like that, I love that phrase, there's no northern and southern ancestors. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all practicing and just ended up practicing from different lineage, But it is all the same. Yeah. And that's what this was really, I mean, I really get it sitting with you guys that it's,
it is.
It looks like we're at the top.
That's great. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm.